Hey there, opera fans. I'm Eric Teague. My pronouns are he, him, his, and I'm primarily a costume designer. You may have seen some of my work in different houses around the U.S., but, fun fact, I'm also a trans man. Ever wondered how alternative identities thrive in the opera world? As someone who makes art for his living, I wanted to explore that question the best way I knew how, by talking to some folks. On this show, I'll speak with other artists who exist under the rainbow umbrella, and talk about life, work, and what makes us shine the brightest. So now I'm wearing a new hat, as your host for Come As You Are, the podcast that goes beyond the curtain with our industry's amazing artists from the LGBTQ+ community and our allies. Think of this as a virtual coffee hour with some fascinating people whose work you've heard or seen in your favorite shows. Whether singers, directors, technicians, or designers, the thing that we share in common is that we all defy the gender expectations often associated with our industry. So grab yourself a cup and join us for a good story. As our first episode here, we thought that it might be nice for you to get an introduction not only to the show itself, but to me as your host. We begin this podcast about stories with my own. And who better to conduct our first interview than the Atlanta Opera's own Tomer Zvulun, a fantastic colleague and a great friend. Welcome to the show, Tomer.
I'm here this morning with my friend, the costume designer and the graphic novel designer and a brilliant man and artist, Eric Teague. Good morning, Eric. How are you?
Hey, morning, Tomer. I'm great. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. So everyone has a story, and we hope that some of those stories will inspire other people. Would you tell us a little bit about yourself, starting with your biography? Where are you from and where did you grow up?
Absolutely. My pronouns are he, him, his, and I came from Cartersville, Georgia, which if y'all are listening from the Atlanta area, you probably know exactly where Cartersville is because it's not terribly far away, and it's getting fancy with all the movie business. But when I grew up, it was a very small, kind of typical southern town, kind of a church on every corner kind of place. And it was, all in all, not a terrible place to grow up. But a little backstory on me, I am transgender. I'm a trans man. And growing up in the South was a little bit of a dodgy situation sometimes, because the world isn't necessarily set up for trans people from the get-go. So you have to figure out your way in the world in kind of an atypical fashion, which I'm thankful for the lifelong friends that I have from the Ville and the great people that I knew there. But I'm also happy that I could spread my wings and go somewhere else.
When did you discover that you're an artist growing up in Cartersville?
Oh, from the get-go. From the moment that I could hold a crayon, there was some kind of art happening. Sometimes it was on the walls of the hallway in our house, much to my mother's chagrin. I think the discouragement to paint on walls was kind of like an early nod not to do scenic design. So...
As a father to two kids, I completely sympathize.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure you do. I was kind of a handful as a kid because you couldn't keep me in enough paper to slake the thirst that I had for drawing and figuring things out. And I naturally loved comic books because they were, A, just so accessible, and the fantastical stories, and they were really gripping, but I also just fell in love with so many art styles through comic books. So that I was trying to emulate as a little kid.
And how do you feel that those stories and art contributed to who you are today?
Well, your development. One of the cool things about comic books is that for the majority of the books that I was able to read as a kid, they were superhero novels. So there was this daytime-nighttime person. You know, like during the daytime, you're mild-mannered Peter Parker, but at nighttime, you're Spider-Man. And having to adjust to a a public face and then a very real face to yourself was something that I identified with immediately, because society would tell me that I needed to be a certain way, but I knew in my heart that I was absolutely something different that they were not ready for yet.
That's an incredible concept, and it's all about identity. And often when we think about superheroes, that's not immediately what came to my mind. So that's just such an interesting angle. So you feel that that double identity of superheroes is something that helped you basically become who you are.
In my like amoeba form as a little kid, it gave me that little inkling of hope that if you want to do something good in the world, but you can't necessarily do it right now, it's okay. You'll grow and you'll be able to become who you want to be. And of course, back then I probably had none of the vocabulary to say any of that, but that little nugget was there, and it sort of helped me go. And it was also a really nice escape into a relatively harmless world. So I loved escaping into a comic book for a little while.
When was that moment for you when you realized that you're different than others? And what did you do with that information?
From my earliest memory, I knew I was absolutely different from anybody else in my community at the time. And I had always been perceived as a androgynous kind of rough and tumble kid, very, you know, interested in doing stupid boy things like running around the woods and poking things with sticks and that kind of stuff. And that was not necessarily the expectation of what my parents had planned out for me for my life. But they knew from the get-go, okay, we've got an atypical kid. We just don't know vocabulary words to attribute to this, or really how to deal with it. So they did their best, you know. They gave me the best sort of right and wrong kind of raising that one could imagine. But there was definitely some tension, because I didn't want to dress like they wanted me to. And they couldn't understand why that was such a big deal, when to me it was the most enormous of deals, because the language of clothing is you're telling the world how you want to be perceived. And when someone imposes a clothing choice on you that is incorrect for you, it's really jarring. And sometimes a kid doesn't have the vocabulary to say that also. And so you just fight. So that makes a lot of tension.
But a lot of artists have people that help them during their development. I call those people angels, people that help us realize who we are and help us get to who we end up becoming. Who are those angels for you? Did you have anybody in your life that helped you become who you are?
Oh, totally. Totally. My father's youngest brother is my favorite uncle, and his name is Greg. And Greg is gay and is an artist at heart. And he pursued music for a long time as a singer. And he was the one that first exposed me to opera and the opera world and things considered high art and things that were elevated and sublime and not just, I call it the Cartersville loop, which is like people get caught in this cycle of the small town where my mama and daddy are from here and I'm going to stay here and I'm going to make some more kids and I'm going to be here for the rest of my life. You know, that kind of thing. And if you can break the loop, if you can break the loop and live as much truth as you can, then some people flourish. And Greg was one of those people, and I'm definitely one of those people, but he was the earliest inclination that art could be a viable career and that I should pursue it instead of pursuing a more practical career, you know.
When you think about so many people that feel different, that feel like they don't belong, what would your advice be to them?
I would say you have to have the strength in your core to believe yourself, because not everybody is going to just believe you. And that's a difficulty growing up as a trans person, because so many people, at least in my case, so many people in my formative years wanted to explain away my behaviors as, oh, well, they'll grow out of it. Your kid's just a tomboy. Plenty of those things. But the truth of the matter was, I've been transgender my entire life, and it's never been some kind of phase. And that's the truth with a lot of people. Now, some folks come to their realization of themselves much later in life as they do more soul searching or have more exposure to trans people who are safe, sane, employed, and living, because there's a tragedy often associated with transness, because that's often what we see in the media, if you see trans people at all. Now, thankfully, that is changing, because we're a significant part of the population, and we're a significant part of the arts, for sure. You're seeing shows like Pose and Euphoria, and shows that show real people that happen to be trans. And that's the casual, cool part of it. They leave all of the drama to the storytelling and not the trans identity. So I guess getting back to what I would say to a young person is, believe yourself and stay strong, and know that your situation will change, because change is the only saving grace in life.
And so the other side of the coin is that tricky journey that led you to where you are probably created some incredible obstacles and difficulties. Ooh. When you think of one of the most difficult ones, what would they be?
Oh, man. Well, when you go through life and your legal ID does not match the physical human that might get pulled over by a police officer in the middle of the night because you've been speeding a little bit, that sense of anxiety is difficult to describe, because, you know, if you don't look like you should on that little card, it could be a world of trouble for you. And it often is for a lot of people. Living with that anxiety day to day was really a challenge. Also the threat of violence. Let's be real. Say if I was out to a bar and I'd had a real good night, and then I'm walking home to my car and somebody clocks me as maybe not their expectations of what a man looks like, that's an invitation to some people for violence. So that was always in the back of my head. You always sort of have that knee-jerk reaction of, how am I going to get out of a place if something bad goes down? So that's baked into the back of my mind in a way. But I say that, but I want you to know that I do not live a life of paranoia. I firmly believe you got to live your life, and bad things will happen because that is the nature of life. You have to be prepared for bad things, but don't live in fear of them. Because if I lived in fear all the time, I'd do nothing. Fear is the mind killer, as they say in Dune. So you stop existing in the world when you give in to nothing but fear. But other things that were really challenging, I began my transition while I was in college. So because I have known myself my whole life, and I came to the realization that I don't want to live with regrets. I want to still be able to grow at the same pace as my cisgendered contemporaries and I needed to make sure that I was in the form that suited me best to do that. So while I guess regular kids were, you know, spending their beer money on beer and movies and whatever, I was going to therapist appointments before class, or I was going to endocrinologist appointments and going on this process with a small group of friends, but not other trans people. I was going it alone in that way. But I really wanted to prove that I could do it. And I wanted to prove that I could do it in Cartersville, of all places. So I did my name change legally at the county courthouse. And I did my gender marker change there as well. Because I didn't know if anybody else had done it before me. But I wanted to make absolutely sure that there was some case in recent memory that could be looked at if someone else was looking to do this.
The realization of how courageous this was is really hitting me. So when you say you did that in college and in Cartersville, so you went to Kennesaw State University for undergrad and then you went to Boston University. Mm-hmm. So this happened while you were still an undergrad.
Yep.
I can't imagine. This is incredible.
Well, it's survival. It's not necessarily courage, I will say. It's survival. For me, it came to the precipice of life or death. It was either you can live how you want to and live your truth because it's there inside of you, or you can check out and be done. Because all of the stress and all of this heartache, it takes its toll on a person, especially a young person. So I made the decision to live. And some people don't get afforded that. So I come from a place of privilege that I could make that decision instead of it being made for me.
And so then you went through the process and you went to Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And I would imagine that spreading your wings in a way and leaving the state that you grew up in was a major point in your life, in your identity, in your career. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Totally, totally. Well, to get to Boston, we have to get to DC first. So through those competitions in college that I was talking about, I got a internship at the Shakespeare Theater in DC. So that was like, I was supposed to graduate college, go to this year-long internship, and then who knows what after that. It was just, you know, take step by step. But unfortunately, at the end of my college career, my father unexpectedly died. It was a shock to the whole family, and I had a very good connection with my father, so it immediately plunged me into a grief and a mourning that was very difficult to deal with. But those angels, as you called them in my life, really rallied. And even though they were grieving too, because a lot of people really loved my dad, they were the ones that said, no, you have to take this internship. You absolutely have to go. We will figure out all the other logistics, because in my grief, I just quit going to class. It was at the end of the semester. I was supposed to take my finals and then graduate in the fall and then go off in the spring. And, you know, when you quit going to class, you can't take your finals. But to his credit, Jamie helped put some perspective on things, and Greg he was of no two minds about it. He's like, no, you got to go. You got to get out of here. You got to go. Don't worry about your mom. I'll take care of your mom. Everything will be okay. We will tend the fort. You've got to do this. And it was the kick in the pants that I needed, because I was totally consumed with grief and the numbness that comes with grief and not knowing the next steps and also not wanting lost. The next steps. Yeah, I was totally lost. Moved to DC with nothing but a suitcase, not knowing a soul, started work 3 days later at this prestigious company in our nation's capital. And that shop was a massive learning experience, but I made some of my best contacts there. The costume director, Deb Shippey, took a shine to me and really took me under her wing and was like, I think you could probably be a designer, but here's the things that you need to polish. And that was exactly what I needed. And also, my wife, who was just a pretty girl in the shop at the time, was on the principal women's stitcher team. So she made all of the beautiful custom gowns for all of the leading ladies. And my job was basically carrying shoes as an intern. So my shoe route would stretch around her table every day because I was just so completely captivated by her. She's incredibly talented. And, you know, she was this beautiful goth girl working in a costume shop. Well, what can I say? So from that job,
I love that.
Deb, my costume director, called some of her friends at BU, Boston University, and said, I've got this guy that might be a good fit for your program. Can he show his work to some people? And it just so happened that Jim Noon, a scenic designer who teaches at Boston University, was designing the set for one of the shows that season. And little did my little intern brain know, but doodling at tech might actually get you somewhere, because Jim had been looking over my shoulder as I was goofing off in tech one day, drawing. And he asked to see my book. So this is still back in the day when you had a physical portfolio. And so I did not have a book, but right. You best believe I went home and made one. So I brought him a book the next day, and
yeah,
he looked at it and was like, he's a very chill guy, Jim. He, like, sometimes you feel like you need to check his pulse.
Very.
Yeah. So he looked at my book and he said, well, maybe you should apply next year. I think we're all full up on our grads this year. So I left from that thinking, okay, fine. You know, maybe grad school's not in the cards for me right now. That's okay. That's fine. And a week later, I had a call offering me a full scholarship. So wow. Crazy stuff happens. And that's how I got to Boston.
So, Eric, fast forward a few years later, and I meet you in Glimmerglass. I heard so much about you before, but then in 2018, we're both in Glimmerglass. You're doing The Cunning Little Vixen. I'm doing Silent Night. We have a nice drink. We talk about it. Let's collaborate in the future. And then the pandemic happens, and we do Three Penny Opera. And I'm like, Eric Teague has to design this show. So when you choose a project, because now you are getting to be a very busy man.
Yes.
Between graphic novels of Phantom of the Opera and Fidelio for Washington National Opera and your very busy career as a costume designer, what makes you choose a project? Like, I would imagine that you have quite a few options. So what is important for you?
Well,
when you choose those projects?
That's a fantastic question. People play a big part in that. Like, is this a team that I really creatively get? And if I leave a meeting and I'm buzzing with ideas and have those aha moments and those moments of exuberance, then I know it's going to be a good fit. And when we would talk about Three Penny Opera, there would be those moments of ahas and those big laughs and those electric moments. So I knew this was going to work out great. So that's a big component for me, is getting the team right. And unfortunately, the timing has to be right. So nuts and bolts things like that. Timing and money are always an important part of that. I wish that I could just let my artistic heart go and, you know, fly off to wherever at any time. But this is a business, and I have to be a businessman at the same time that I'm being an artist. So over many years, I have learned that make sure to pay attention to your calendar and make sure that you pay attention to the cash side of things, because that's what's keeping you going to do everything. The other thing is, I mean, just the subject matter. If I get offered a show that is a bucket list show like Three Penny that I've always wanted to do and I've always wanted to do in a crazy way, absolutely, I want to take that over something that perhaps I've done before or I've seen someone else do before really beautifully. And that I know there are things that I do well as a designer, and there are some things that other folks do way better as a designer. So there's enough work for all of us, I firmly believe. So I should take the things that really, really appeal.
It feels like you went through a big change in the past couple of years, because when I met you and spoke to you, you did not share any of this.
Yeah.
And it was not public knowledge about your trans journey.
Yeah.
And you made a decision, I think about a year ago, to talk about it publicly. What led you to that, again, courageous choice? Because I think it's so important to share it so that other people are inspired by it. But what made you take that choice?
Well, for a long time, my sense of survival was staying under the radar. Like, yeah, let your weirdness be the thing that people focus on. Us, goth guy, whatever. So I let that, again, be my armor for my trans journey that was underneath that, out of a sense of safety and a sense of security. And the people closest to me all knew, of course, and I had those very select few who were my safe community. But I still was in very much that mindset of keep it close, keep it secret. That's yours to tell. And it doesn't need to go anywhere else. It's nobody's business. But over the pandemic, like a lot of people, I had plenty of time to just sit and think. Because when I'm in full production mode, there's not a lot of sitting and thinking unless it's about work. So you expend so much energy working, taking time to reflect on yourself is not often on the table. And that's true of anybody. Anybody with a really demanding career has to fight to take those times to think, well, how am I doing in me? What's my temperature in me? And do I need to talk about anything and stuff like that? And regular therapy works. But all of my shows got the axe, and then we all went into quarantine. And I just kept thinking, this is the one area in my life that I'm not completely open about. And I value honesty above pretty much anything else. So I felt like I wasn't being honest with the world. Not that I owe anything to anybody. Let's be clear on that. Your truth is your truth, and you choose what you want to do with it. But I felt like I could probably do some good in the world if I was more open about it. So I made the decision that it's time. I want to start making more art about this subject. I want to start exploring that a lot more. And I think it's time. So I made a big old Facebook post because I'm a millennial and that's how we get news out now. And I sent it off in the world and had no idea how that was going to go. Because 10 years ago, it would have been a career-threatening thing. But thankfully, not anymore.
I do have one last question, and it's coming from a bit of a vulnerable place.
Okay.
For me. And that is... We live in a world, and I'm very grateful for it, that is very sensitive, where we want to make sure that when we talk about things, we are using the correct ways. And as we learn more and more about stories of transgenders, trans men, trans women, one of the things that I noticed with my team that is very passionate about sharing those stories is wanting to make sure that we use the correct terms, mm-hmm. that we are not saying something that will come across as offensive. Do you have any advice for us as we launch this podcast and a festival that features As One?
Absolutely. And my first step of advice is listen to the humans you're talking about. So when someone offers you their pronoun, that's sacred. That is, this person has told you how they feel. So you must respect that at all costs. It does not matter what you think you know about a person. You don't. Listen to the person. So pronouns will be aggressively respected from my point of view. And I say aggressively respected, people make mistakes, and mistakes are okay. Just correct yourself and move on. Don't dwell on it. Don't belabor the point. Or if you are corrected, just nicely say, oh, okay, correct and move on. And that's all you got to do. That's all you got to do.
I don't even begin to imagine, like I said, the journey that you've been through. But there is so much that your story stir up in me as well. And I'm so grateful that you shared it. And I look forward to working with you, Eric. Thank you.
Absolutely. I want to thank Tomer so much for this interview today. When he asked me to do this podcast, my first thought was, for real? I do costumes, you know, not podcasts. And certainly not podcasts about deep personal issues and art. It seemed really crazy to me. But I took a moment and I realized what an amazing opportunity it was that he wanted to hand me the mic. So from here on out, I will be your host for this show. I'll use our lovely time together to speak with people from different disciplines and backgrounds in an effort to normalize queer artists' lives through their stories. Because at heart, good artists are storytellers, and we've all got a good one. Another huge thanks goes out to the team at the Atlanta Opera, who has made this podcast possible with their awesome support. I hope you enjoy listening and maybe learning a little something about living in somebody else's skin. And remember, y'all means all. So come as you are, and the spotlight is waiting. Bye, y'all.